from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, women have been more present than ever before in the ongoing discontent and uprisings we are presently witnessing sweeping throughout the Middle East and North Africa. What will the effects be on women's rights and women's equality as transformations of old regimes occur? We'll take that up with a panel of women in the hour ahead, and we'll include your calls, emails, and your online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Women have been in the forefront of the protests that have assailed governments across the Middle East and North Africa. What will the effect of regime changes be on women's rights? More freedom or more restrictions? The region has been marked by a wide range of treatment and overall status of women. From the over 70% literacy rate for generally well-educated women with abortion rights and more parliamentary seats than the French in Tunisia, to Bahrain, where women are prohibited from voting or driving, and Iran, where they can be stoned for adultery. The big unknown, of course, is fundamentalism. When one looks at the effect of the Islamic Revolution in Iran or the takeover by the Taliban in Afghanistan, hope for women's rights can be dimmed by the reality of the setting in of profound gender oppression, though hope and euphoria for democratic ideals have fueled the revolutions that have recently occurred and are continuing as we speak. In this forum hour, we discuss the question of the role of women and women's rights in the changing nations of the Middle East and North Africa. Joining us is Leila Ahmed, professor in the Harvard Divinity School. She's an Egyptian-born scholar whose work focuses on women and Islam in the Middle East and in the United States. Her book, which will come out this spring, is called A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. And Leila Ahmed, we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Good to have you. Leila Ahmed is with us this morning from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Also with us this morning from New York City is Manaz Afkami, who is founder and president of Women's Learning Partnership. She's also the former minister for women's affairs in Iran. And we welcome you to the program. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And again, we're also welcoming to this panel Yakim Ertürk, who is former UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, also professor of sociology with the Middle East Technical University in Ankara, Turkey. She's a member of the European Committee for the Prevention of Torture and again is with us from our bureau in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
Glad to have you all aboard. And Leila Ahmed, I want to begin with you to talk a bit about Egypt with you. There were certainly a lot of women, as I said, present in the protests and behind the scenes, many of them defying their families and challenging social taboos. And Egypt has kind of been ahead a bit as far as the region where women are concerned. But at present, there's a committee making up a constitution and no women on it.
Well, yes, absolutely, you're right. Which tells us immediately there are taboos yet to be broken, and that the also tells us that the people in charge are not yet in sync with what's been happening on the street, and with the ideals of the young people who brought about this revolution.
Well, women, you could say, on some levels, the Women's Council had a good deal to launch in launching this movement. That viral video, and let's talk about that of Asmin Mahfouz.
Yes, yes. Asma Mahfouz, she was a member of the something called the April 6th group, which also became a Facebook group, which was founded a couple of years ago to support workers' rights in one of the main industrial cities in Egypt. And they've been growing ever since, and they have been absolutely vital to this movement. And Asma Mahfouz was the one who is credited with having made a video, which she sent out on Facebook, urging people to go into the streets, not to be afraid to come out with hope. And she said, if you say there's no hope, then there is no hope. But you have to come out and put your bodies on the line. And that apparently was the video that got everybody moving.
It was quite a catalyst. Yes. Still, the big question that looms, as I said in my introduction, is just how much of a force fundamentalist Islam will be. And I'm prompted by asking you about the fact that, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood, which will play a role, no question about it, in forming a new government, has said no woman, well, they've also said no Christian, can be a head of state.
Well, you know, actually, the Muslim Brotherhood is a complex organization. So when you tell me that they have said that no woman can be head of state, I know, as it happens, the book that you just mentioned, I was following out why we have the veil today in Egypt and in America. When I was growing up 50 years ago, there were no women. Most women did not wear hijab. And to follow out that story, I studied the Muslim Brotherhood, because they really are the heart of why we have the veil today globally, including here in America. And I see that they have actually quite a diversity of views with among the intellectuals. So there are, I've read certainly important intellectuals who argue that women can be heads of state. And in fact, one of them used the example of Golda Meir to show how good women could be as head of state. So it's a complex situation with many varieties of views. It's true the predominant views within the Muslim Brotherhood are conservative, but as I followed out what happened as their ideas took root in America, I see that actually some of the most active feminist women are women who are part of this new Islamic revival, which the Muslim Brotherhood are part of.
It's fair to say, though, is it not, that Egypt is still largely very strongly religious in terms of identification with Islam, and that it's still male hegemonic to a great degree?
Yes, I would agree, although I would say that it's strongly religious, both Muslims and Christians. I mean, I think for both communities, religion is very important.
Leila.
And it is male hegemonic, no doubt about it, too.
Well,
I'm
sorry. So what can be done, or what should be done to ensure that women will have an equal voice, or that women will have parity?
Well, let me qualify male hegemonic. It is that, and it is officially that. I mean, this is the there's no ideology, publicly, broadcast ideology across the culture saying that it should be gender egalitarian in the way that it is in America. But nevertheless, there are and have been for many decades important women's organizations that have been fighting for this. Women have had the vote, after all, for more than 50 years now in Egypt. They're in the economy, they're educated at the same level or even higher than men. They have university degrees, they are in all the professions. So there is no nominal commitment to gender equality, but in fact there has been tremendous progress over the last 50 or 60 years.
And you're hoping that will continue, and that will continue largely through, men and women joining hands and working together on that behalf?
That's right. I am, because, if you follow what the young people said who made this revolution, the women say, I'm here because I want justice and the end of corruption to government. Now, she's not fighting for justice for men only, obviously, and I think the vast majority of women who are involved in this also want justice for themselves, for women. So the issue is, are they going to be able to win it from whoever takes power, and how it all unfolds now? That I can't say, but I am very hopeful.
Leila Ahmed, again, is professor in the Harvard Divinity School, Egyptian-born scholar, and her work focuses on women and Islam in the Middle East and here in the United States. And her book comes out this spring. It's called A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. Manaz Afkami is founder and president of Women's Learning Partnership, also former minister for women's affairs in Iran. And certainly there's been a great deal of euphoria, but I remember the euphoria when the Iranian revolution, and then things took quite a turn. Should we be worried about that? And to what extent ought we to be worried about that?
Well, Michael, I think we should be very worried about that, because, of course, it's exciting and invigorating to see young people demanding justice and having courage and pushing the autocracy out of power. And who wouldn't wish for the dawn of democracy? But the problem is that democracy is something that has to be learned. It's a process. It's not a casting of a vote or pushing out of dictators only. It's believing in a culture of negotiation, consensus, diversity, and so forth, as we all know. And there hasn't been a chance for all of that to develop yet. There are not enough strong civic organizations. There have been, of course, some, and of course there have been several women's groups and organizations that have shown all sorts of innovation and dedication. But it's one thing to have that sort of beginning of consciousness raising, and another thing to have strong institutions. And to go back to what Leila mentioned, there is none of these societies where there is an open and strong commitment to secularism, which is the base of democracy. That is, if you want freedom of religion, if you want gender justice, if you want freedom of expression and interaction, you have to have countries which deeply believe no one religion, no one sect of one religion can be the dominant force in legislating and in running the affairs of state. And none of these countries have a history of that, and none of these countries have an open and well-stated commitment to that ideology. And this is why when you have groups like Muslim Brotherhood or others who have a certain amount of diversity within them, but they're the ones who are generally conservative, and they are the ones who have some semblance of networking. They have they're reasonably well funded, and they also have a history of helping people and giving charitable resources and services, and so that kind of thing brings puts them ahead of the other groups in terms of influence. And of course we see that in the idea that none of the transition entities have a strong presence of women, and in the Constitution there is no presence by women.
And yet you've said, I believe, that the future of the Middle East is all about women, and you're talking about organizing and human rights advocacy and all of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I still think that the history is about women. That is, our success or failure in terms of shaping democracy depends on how successful we are, both as women's groups inside these countries, as international groups giving solidarity, as governments making sure that they support the groups who are really for justice and equality for all, and for media to who have an extraordinary influence. They reverberate back in these countries. They help shape values and shape priorities. And if all of that is focused, not on wishful thinking, but in actual practical, processes that we know, we have seen over at least 200 years or more in this country and in other countries, what works in terms of bringing about democracies. So if everybody puts their heads together and their minds together and strongly supports these movements, and women being at the center of it. You see, you can't have a democracy with all of the values that we believe in without having women, who are 50% of the population, be a part of it.
And yet the Arab countries, I believe, have the lowest level of political party participation. It's even lower than African countries.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this has been the case, even though they are, as Leila said, skilled. They have learned a lot. Many of them are in universities. Right now, for instance, in Iran, you have 60% of university students are women. But that doesn't necessarily translate into policy-making positions, power, and the possibility of shaping the future of your society, and that's what we need to all work for. So negatively or positively, it's all about women.
Well, you mentioned 60% in Iran of women being educated. I'd like to get your perspective on the differences that perhaps exist with respect to Shia countries like Iran, Shia-dominated countries, as opposed to Sunni-dominated countries. On the one hand, you have, like in Saudi Arabia, which is more Wahhabi, women still can't drive. And in Bahrain, not only can't they drive, they can't vote. And that's largely a Sunni-run but Shia-majority country. And in Iran, like I said in my introduction, women can still be stoned for adultery. I mean, the differences seem to be fairly distinct, and yet Islam seems the centerpiece here.
Well, actually, that's one of the things that our partnership, who works in 20 countries, mostly Muslim majority, deeply believes in, is that there is no exceptionalism about Islam. It's all about the culture of democracy and development. And I think that people need to experience that and be placed in positions where they can deal with these issues. Other religions have also had to deal with this, and they have had a chance to do that and to develop in ways that are conducive to democracy. I don't think the different sects of Islam make any difference. Bahrain is largely Shia. Iran is primarily Shia. There are Sunni countries that are more progressive. I don't think sects of Islam or Islam itself is the only factor here. And, you know, there's another thing that has become very popular since this clash of civilizations rhetoric has gained momentum and the wars have influenced people's thinking, as if people in Muslim-majority countries wake up every morning and all they think about is about the Quran or the prayer or the mosque. Muslim-majority countries are largely made up of 70% below the age of 30 young people, and the young people want economic empowerment, they want jobs, they want access to change, they want entertainment, they want culture, they want to fall in love, they want to have a happy circumstance, they want to have good health care. They have a lot of things on their minds, and religion happens to be one of the things that shapes their values, and not for everybody.
They want many things, as you suggest, that are Western and that are against what fundamentalists want.
They want many things that are human. Human, not Western. They want well-being, human stuff, you know, and religion is one part of it. Just as for Christians, for many Christians, religion is a very important, you know, foundation for values, but that's not what people think about. Some of them only on Sundays, and some of them not even on Sundays.
Manas Afghami, again, is founder and president of the Women's Learning Partnership and also former minister for women's affairs in Iran. And Yakin Ertuk is also with us, former UN Special Rapporteur for Violence Against Women and Professor of Sociology at Middle East Technical University in Ankara. And Yakin Ertuk, Turkey, of course, is a largely Muslim country, but it's also a country that is secular, and that, in many people's judgment, has worked to the advantage where women are concerned?
Oh, I would definitely say so. Turkey is a 98% Muslim country. So it's predominantly Sunni. So one would think that if religion was the defining factor only, things would be different in Turkey. But I think we're looking at the world in a snapshot today. Islam has appeared as an important sphere of cultural and political competition and opposition. Therefore, we have the tendency to define the world in terms of Islam. But I think there are many, many different dynamics that need to be taken into consideration. And the issue of secularism, as Mahnaz has also mentioned, I think has been an advantage, has given a woman sort of a lead in pushing for their demands. And, of course, there are many problems with the Turkish secularism, and we are discussing it and debating it today. We have a political party in power who comes from an Islamist tradition. I think it has their regime or their time in power has been a good indicator of what has become rooted in a country like Turkey. And, of course, the reforms started in 1923 with Turkey becoming a republic after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And in the nearly 80 years, while things have gone wrong in this country, we see that certain things have become rooted. And no matter what political orientation rules the country, it has to engage with these institutions that have become rooted. So Islam takes a very different form, even if there is an intentional effort to assert Islamic identity. So in that sense, I think there are, and when you talk about women in any of these countries, and Turkey as well, there is not one voice. There are many different voices. Women of different backgrounds and groups have different visions.
No, there's great diversity. The kind of life. I understand. But Turkey is often held up as a paradigm or as a model of what a republic can be with a majority of Muslims. And on the one hand, for example, the current criminal code has been reformed in Turkey. Provisions with respect to rape and other sexual assault were once crimes against public morality, but not crimes against women's bodily integrity. Now that's changed. It's a crime against the person, the woman, and these changes have happened because of women. On the other hand, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe honor killings have gone up in Turkey.
It's hard to say here because we never had figures in the past, but it's quite likely that as women's situation is changing and getting more visibility, and the old system where control over women is eroding, the reaction, patriarchal reaction, is going to be strong. And the so-called honor killings appear to be on the increase and more visible today. But I think this is very normal when a problem is being dissected, if I may say. The old trends resist and try to survive. But the legal provisions, at least, have been strengthened in this regard, and there is a great deal of public awareness. So the shame in the so-called honor crime has been turned in the public discourse from the woman who has allegedly dishonored the family to the ones who are punishing her. And I think this is a very important state of mind and an important public discourse that needs to be taken into consideration.
But we're also seeing continued underrepresentation of women in parliament in Turkey and inequality as far as employment, correct?
Turkey is among the worst in the world in terms of development indicators. You look at level of illiteracy, almost 20% women are illiterate. You look at health indicators, very bad indicators, only 9% in the parliament. These are such a contrast to the vibrancy of the women's movement, because women have become an important voice in determining public discourse. So Turkey is a country of extreme contradictions, I'm afraid, in this regard.
Well, I want to bring our listeners into this conversation. We're talking about the role of women in countries undergoing change and in Turkey, which, as I said, has become, in many people's minds, a model because of its being a secular state and having secular institutions. And if you would like to join this conversation, if you have questions or comments or simply have something you'd like to put forth as your own opinion or your own sense of what's going to happen, and we certainly don't know what's going to happen in many of these countries, results as far as transformation, one can only envision at this point in many instances. But we'd like to hear from you. And if you have something you'd like to say, by all means, feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And we welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, the toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And forum is also now on Facebook. Talking with Leila Ahmed, professor in the Harvard Divinity School, and Manaz Afkami, founder and president of the Women's Learning Partnership, and Yakim Arturk, who is former UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and professor of sociology at the Middle East Technical University in Ankara. Also, by the way, a member of the European Committee for the Prevention of Torture. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on Middle East regime changes and what it will mean for women. Over the past 2 months, protest movements have transformed the face of governments across the Middle East and North Africa. And as the upheaval continues, we are examining the role of women in these demonstrations and how new regimes will affect women's rights throughout the region. Will they bring greater freedoms or will they impose further constraints? With us Yakin Ertürk, who is former UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Professor of Sociology with the Middle East Technical University in Ankara, Turkey. She's also a member of the European Committee for the Prevention of Torture. Manaz Afkami is founder and president of the Women's Learning Partnership. She's also the former Minister for Women's Affairs in Iran. And Leila Ahmed is professor in the Harvard Divinity School, Egyptian-born scholar whose work focuses on women and Islam in the Middle East and America. Her forthcoming book, which will be out in the spring, is called A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. And you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or you can join us by going onto our website and posting your question or comment there. It's kqed.org/forum, and you simply click on this segment. I want to go to your calls and emails here, and in fact, let's begin with a caller, Bovina from Santa Clara. Good morning.
Hi. I'm sorry, my name is Bovina.
Bovina.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm calling because a comment was made that Turkey is upheld as this model of secularism amongst Muslim-majority countries. And in my mind, secularism is the freedom of expression or freedom of conscience, not the forced absence of religion. But in Turkey, the headscarf is in fact banned from public places. And I don't see that as a freedom of expression or freedom of conscience, but rather forced absence of religion.
Now let's get a comment from Yakin Ertürk on that.
I think you're pointing to a very significant problem. Secularism is as deep as your democracy is. So I think in Turkey, this is one of the issues that is definitely on Turkey's agenda. Women who are covered are demanding their rights. And the definition of secularism, which is based on a very restrictive understanding, is being challenged today. And however, what is important is that an environment of such debate and dialogue is possible. And I feel that if Turkey resolves this problem, it will definitely move to a higher level of democracy where its secularism will be an issue of guarantee and not a dictation of a single understanding. So in that sense, I certainly do agree.
Well, let me go to you, Manaz Afkami, because there's a notion that you need freedom of religion for change, that Islam has perhaps been more slow with respect to movement for women's rights throughout this region. Some thoughts on that?
Yes. I wouldn't necessarily point to Islam as the cause of the lagging of democratic practices. Again, it's a matter of development and the individuals becoming aware of their own rights. But the thing that is very important in terms of democracy and secularism and religion is that once you experience a sort of a perfect storm of this kind, which the Iranian Revolution brought about, a theocracy, the only theocracy that we have in the world, once you have something like that, people seem to be leaning more towards secularism. Right now, for instance, the population in Iran, and especially the young, are probably, arguably, more secular than any other in the entire Middle East because they have seen what it's like when religion becomes the government. And people are just actually even negating religion because religion is in effect in the person of the leader, the great leader, and the others who are running the government. Religion is made responsible for garbage disposal, for health services, for roads that work or don't work. And people have become really sort of, many of them, the young especially, rejecting not only that version of religion, but it seems all religion. So what we really want to go toward is the idea of freedom to believe the way they people each person, each group wants to believe and have the space to express that particular faith or ideology or value system. And that's what is the ideal that we want to go toward.
Well, we have the example that often comes to my mind of Hirsi Ali, whom many of us admire and who was extraordinarily courageous, but who nevertheless has, identified herself as an atheist and probably has turned off a lot of religious women who may be in favor of women's rights. How does all this tie in with the veil? You've got a book coming out about the resurgence of the veil, and the veil in many people's minds is certainly symbolic of this, confusion about women's rights and religion. And tell us a little bit, if you could, about how you see it.
Well, yes. The veil actually today is, what you said, in many people's minds, it is a sign of that. And that is the issue. It's part of the narrative that we tell ourselves, that the veil is oppressive. But what I find on the ground is that women, particularly in America and in Europe, who choose to wear it, or are choosing to wear it, not at all. They're often very committed feminists. So it really has no relation to any sense, the idea that they are oppressed. It's a complex... It has many complex and sometimes political meanings. Some of them wear it because they want to call attention to sexism that they see in our society, that they see Western dress as very sexist. So there are all of these complexities. But if I may, I'd just like to say something in relation with secularism. And while I broadly agree with Mahnaz and Yakin, and I actually very much appreciated their responses, I do want to point out that actually... In Egypt does have a history of parliamentary democracies. We had 30 years of it, in which governments changed one after another according to the elections. It does have a system of electoral process in system in place, although it has been abused and it has not been transparent. So it has these resources to draw on. And then on the issue of secularism, Egypt was secular in the sense of, in its constitution when it was in 1922 when it got independence from the British, in the sense that people of all religions participated and were members of the government. So there is that history to draw on, and as Yakin said, secularism can have many meanings. And societies which are historically multi-religious, multi-religiousness is not new to the Middle East.
Well, let me go, if I may, back to, just for a moment, before I go to more calls here, to you, Manaz Afkami, because the revolution was decidedly theocratic and religious in Iran, and you were slated, marked for execution by that revolution. How much of that had to do with, your feminism or the principles for women's rights?
Well, I think the entire thing was based on that. To my thinking, the Iranian revolution had, of course, complex and multiple reasons, but at the base of it and at the center of it was the visibility of women and the level of participation that they had, which was very much resented by the fundamentalists and the radical Islamists. So in my own case, that was the main reason that I was designated as the corrupt of the earth and warrior with God, a designation which at first really put me off considerably, but now since a whole lot of wonderful women have been designated exactly the same, it's sort of a proud club to be a member
Become
of.
Become a badge of honor, yes, I understand that. Let me bring another caller on here, and we go to Yusuf next. Yusuf, join us, please.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry? Not a very good connection, I'm afraid. We'll have to try to... he was actually bringing up the question of Morocco, I believe, had a sister in Morocco. Morocco also... really does not have, is it fair to say, Manaz Afkami, quite like Tunisia and Egypt, it's had a bit more enlightened qualities than, say, Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or certainly Libya.
That's right. Recently, especially in the recent decade, the Moroccans have done wonderful work in terms of changing family laws, which are at the base of women's rights in society, right to divorce, right to travel, right to choose a career. All of that is in the family laws, and Moroccans have had an exceptionally advanced family law. They have done a lot on convention on the elimination of discrimination against women. women, the UN Women's Convention. They have removed a lot of reservations which were given by the government regarding that declaration. So they have advanced quite a bit, and we have a very strong partner in Morocco, ADFM, who are working very well with helping women become politically savvy, learn how to be exceptionally aware voters and citizens at the same time, knowing how to build constituencies, how to run for office, how to formulate a message, a political message, and so forth, all the lessons that we need for political participation. And so they have created tools, manuals and learning tools, and do trainings on political participation, which is very important. So we're hoping that the reforms in Morocco will be expedited and sort of avoid any kind of an explosion, which is really very costly in the end. If one can have reforms without an explosion, it's much preferable.
And here's a listener who remarks with a web comment, "I would like the speakers to address the significance of President Obama's speech in Cairo with regard to the current revolutions. He spoke about government by the people and for the people, and that seems to be what is happening both for men and women." That's certainly a positive spin on things. Leila Ahmed, get your thoughts.
Well, I'm sure it's important to have that, but of course the example of America and of democracy around the world have been also something that the young people have had before them. So I think it's many, many factors that went into causing people to demand these rights now. Well, I understand they also studied the revolutions in Eastern Europe before launching theirs.
Oh, here's another listener who writes, "As we look at other nations and their struggles, we must acknowledge our own halting progress. How long did it take for women to get the right to vote after our Constitution was first drafted? And how many women are in positions of political leadership in our own Congress? The beam in our own eye is still pretty large." And here's
That's true.
I'm sorry, yes. Here's Lee who writes, "Unaccompanied women are likely to be sexually harassed or even assaulted in the streets in Egypt, regardless of whether they're wearing Western dress or a burqa. Is this equally common in other Muslim-majority countries? What can be done to address it? And to what extent is this the canary in the coal mine regarding women's rights in Muslim countries?" Who would like to speak here?
Well, you know, separating the world as Muslim and this is Yakinar, by the way, Muslim world and non-Muslim world, when you're talking about women's issues, can be very misleading. I know today the world's eyes are on the Muslim countries because the veil sort of symbolizes in many people's minds women's oppression and all that. But one of your listeners did make a very pertinent issue that patriarchy is a very universal phenomenon. Many of the Western European countries and United States just 30, 40 years ago was in a very different place with respect to women's rights issues. I did my PhD in Cornell. When I left in 1980, there was not a single female faculty member in my department. And as we all know, many of the Ivy League's universities didn't accept women until very recently. I think we should look at male hegemony and how patriarchy manifests itself in different social and economic contexts rather than make this clear dichotomy between Muslim countries and non-Muslim. Yes, there are specific problems in the Muslim-majority countries today, but many of these are not because necessarily they're Muslim, but I think the whole issue of power politics is a missing element in our discussion today. Leila made some very important observations that we should keep in our minds. One, 50 years ago, women were not wearing the veil. In many of these countries, it was not an issue. I know in my own country, it was not. Secondly, that secular trends and institutions existed way back in the early 1920s. So how
you still have, excuse me, do you not still have the headscarf controversy going on as we're speaking in Turkey to a major degree?
Sorry,
there's still a major controversy in Turkey over wearing headscarves.
Oh, definitely. This is because of what we discussed a little while ago, very restrictive and exclusive understanding of secularism, which did not allow for any religious expression aside from what the ruling classes saw fit. So it's a matter of democratization. But the issue of power of politics internationally needs to be taken into consideration. In the Cold War era, the Palestine issue in the Middle East are two very important issues where some of the trends that we see today, radicalization of Islam and so forth, emerged in response to some of the wider political issues. And in some cases, they were not only tolerated, but supported. So I think your last question with regard to President Obama's comment, I think that's very welcomed. But we need to see how the big powers respond and support democratic processes in the Middle East from now here on. I mean, this is an important issue. To what extent will the Middle East be given a chance to democratize?
And once again, Yakin Ertürk is former UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Professor of Sociology, Middle East Technical University in Ankara, Turkey. And we'll go to a caller. Diane, good morning. You're on.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I've met you several times. I'm a former women's studies professor, now a freelance travel writer. I've traveled pretty widely in the Middle East. A few years ago was in Libya, and one of the things that interested me was that Gaddafi, strange as he is, seemed to trust women a lot. He had his security guards were female. Women I met in Libya were going to university, driving, having jobs. And
they were
on.
Mainly big blondes, however. They were not Arab women.
Yeah, well, that's another story. But he did. I remember the interview with Arianna Falaci, where she was the first woman, first interviewer I think he had from the West, and he trusted her because she was a woman. There are a lot of contradictions, of course. Where do people see Libya now? As far as I haven't been there in 4 years or 5 years. And this whole issue of women's rights there.
Well, right now in Libya, they're killing people left and right. I mean,
yeah. I understand.
And we want to comment on that, Manas Afkami?
I think Libya is one of the most desperate situations, and it's very hard to predict because Mr. Gaddafi is a very unpredictable. I mean, he's predictable in his unpredictability, so it's very difficult to say what he'll do next. And so that's a most unfortunate situation, and it's good that some of the governments and international forces are trying to somehow influence the level of aggression that he's actually perpetrating.
Getting back to women, the caller is right in a way. Gaddafi, some of it was window dressing, but he showed at least a sense of being more enlightened or more open toward where women were concerned. And again, I think it was ornamental for the most part, but it
ornamental.
Went on.
Yes,
yes, definitely.
Education, working, and so on.
Yeah. Well, let me thank you for that call. And Yusuf, I think we have you this time on the air here with us.
Yeah.
Better connection.
Yeah, we do. Thank you. So I was just saying that I'm from Morocco, and I wanted to relate to you guys a conversation I was, not one, but several times, the conversations that I was having with my sister, who is quite educated and quite independent, I tell you. And I get the sense from her that her worries and a lot of women's worries in Morocco, for instance, is that they don't trust yet where Western societies have are, for instance, they don't know if it's going to disintegrate in say 50 years because of these values say that women are not are working all the time and not raising their children, for instance. And I tell you, my sister has studied abroad in Europe, and so there is this they're pretty reluctant in embracing all, say, quote unquote Western values, although I think they're universal values in some sense. And so they don't know, they're really worried, I think, from what I can tell from what you're saying about society in general they're really confused, I think, also about they mix human rights with things that are Western in a sense that the way women dress, for instance. It's a very big concern in Islamic countries. Say a free woman does not necessarily mean a woman who a nude beach, for instance. And these are real questions that are actually are discussed in society over there. And so I wonder, as far as Egypt and these countries that are going through historical change, how that's going to play out and what's the route they're going to take.
I don't know if any of our obviously very accomplished and distinguished women can make predictions about the future, but the sense one has is that these kinds of subjects, particularly with the sort of technology we have today, are being discussed for the most part. We have, you know, a global village, as McLuhan called it, Twitter and with Facebook and all the rest. And as a result, these kinds of questions do come up in all these Islamic countries and are part of the ongoing discourse, are they not?
Well, if I may say so, I think they're part of the ongoing discourse here in America. If you recall that feminism in the 60s and 70s protested against sexist dress, and they objected to the way women having to wear sexy dress or revealing dress and so on. So this is an ongoing concern for feminists, among others, in the West. And it's, I think the only problem is, I mean, the ongoing concern is there too much fragmentation of society? Are there problems introduced by the kind of commercial world in which we live? But unfortunately, too, there is a strong element which sees women's rights and women's liberation as somehow to blame for everything that's going wrong in the West. And that's where feminists probably part company with others.
I know, Leila, you've been emphasizing the fact that there's a great deal of diversity, of course, among Islamic countries, and patriarchy is really perhaps what we've been calling the center, what I've been calling the centerpiece here, more than Islam. But you know, you can wear a miniskirt in Tunisia, you can't in Iran. And to some extent, one might argue that this may have to do with what is seen as by the mullahs in Iran, Sharia, as opposed to the more secularization or westernization of a country like Tunisia under the now deposed Ben Ali.
You know, well,
Michael, I was going to say that one of the things that that is affecting the way people think about each other across South and North, West and East, is a sort of a mutual stereotyping. You know, it's the Eastern and especially Muslim majority countries also get an idea of what women in the West are like from some movie and television shows, which none of the people that I've known living in the United States or other Western countries resemble. You know, I mean, in this country, women are working hard, they're serious, they're taking care of their lives. They're not going around the way that MTV or some of these shows portray them. But what people in these countries see is these images, which are highly exaggerated and highly unreal with regards to actual life of women in the West. So the stereotyping is both ways, the way that the West sees the Muslim women as veiled and segregated and incapable of making decisions, and vice versa about the naked, promiscuous Western woman. So unfortunately, the technology and media has helped a great deal in terms of communication and openness, but it hasn't yet brought people closer to understanding the reality of people's lives and people's aspirations and how similar they really are.
Maybe it's even, as you suggest or intimate, exacerbated the stereotypes. Huh?
In some ways, I think it has. But of course, in terms of our subject of today, that is the idea of democratization and the impact of women's lives vis-a-vis democratization. I think the communication and technology has been extraordinarily important. Just as anybody recalls the fall of the Soviet Union, people used to say at that time the fax machine was behind it. But and of course, a lot of opening in terms of communication, whether it was the telephone or the fax or whatever, had a lot to do with it. And in our our day, I think people seeing how other people live and communicating with each other, at least at the level of the young and the connected, has made a lot of difference, and it will in the future more and more. So, and I think a lot of learning happens that is positive, and I think that will hopefully help with the eradicating this mutual prejudice and stereotyping.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. Ahmed, thank you for waiting. Join us on forum. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm originally from Egypt. I've been in the U.S. for the last 10 years. I grew up in Egypt, and my view is not as oppressive to women. I mean, the way I see Egypt society, I lived in Cairo. If you look across different areas in the world, you would see that, especially if you look like in Asia, for instance, you see that there's even far more oppressive societies than something like in Egypt, for instance. I know people from Asia, from, say, China, Japan, or so on, even it's much more developed societies, but still there's a different view about women in these societies.
Okay.
Another thing, if you look also just even closely, like even in Israel, you would find that there's certain cities where they have even separate buses for women and men, and have even as like, you know, covered women and everything in such society, which we consider as a much more democratic society.
Great, Ahmed. Thank you for that call. And we're short on time here. I get the sense from the three of you that we've had with us this whole hour, and again, I appreciate your being with us, that there is hope, and you're all looking at it positively as far as the role that women will play and an ongoing hope of an integral role for women to play, and a very significant one. And we'll hope, indeed, that will be the case. We'll continue, obviously, to monitor and watch the events as they unfold. I wanted to thank all of our guests. Leila Ahmed, again, is professor in the Harvard Divinity School, Egyptian-born scholar. Her book, which will be out in the spring, is A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America. And Yakin Ertürk is former U.N. Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Professor of Sociology at Mideast Technical University in Ankara, Turkey. She's also a member of the European Committee for the Prevention of Torture. And Manas Afkami is founder and president of the Women's Learning Partnership and also former minister for women's affairs in Iran. Let me thank you one and all, and thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you that Forum is now on Facebook, and you can also let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org or calling 415-553-3300. Forum's produced by Kevin Guillory, Amy Machado, and Erica Kelly. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Adam Hill, Douglas Ray, Julia James, Suki Lewis, Katrina Schwartz, and Vinnie Tong. And another hour of Forum coming up. We're going to talk about aging with Susan Jacoby, one of our great public intellectuals. When we return, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.